Hey guys, it's Max here. Today we are releasing a special bonus episode of our Untitled Rothfuss podcast. This was recorded back in August at Gen Con. Pat and I actually recorded it in case something went wrong, but it turned out really good, and I wanted to share it with all of you. Something we didn't mention at the end of last week's podcast, if you want to stay up to date on me or Pat and the projects that we're doing and any news on the future of the podcast or stuff that we're working on together, you can follow us on Twitter. That's probably the easiest way. I'm at Max Temkin, M-A-X-T-E-M-K-I-N, and Pat is at Patrick Rothfuss, P-A-T-R-I-C-K-R-O-T-H-F-U-S-S. And I also highly recommend staying up to date on Pat's blog, which you can find at blog.patrickrothfuss.com. And I think there'll be some good news on the podcast and some other projects we're doing together in the near future. This special bonus episode of Untitled Rothfuss is brought to you by our friends at Backblaze. If you remember a few weeks ago when Pat almost lost a draft of a book he's working on, I demanded that he use Backblaze. Backblaze is a service I love. It's an unlimited online backup service for your Mac or PC, and it just works. It just runs in the background, and it silently and securely backs up all of your stuff so you never have to think about it or worry about losing your work or losing any of your digital information. Backblaze is just $5 per month per computer. There's no tricks or gimmicks. It's really simple, and it really just works. Rarely has any technology solved a problem like this completely in my life. I really love these guys, and I'm so excited to share it with all of you, and I'm so happy that Pat, I'm pretty sure, is using this thing. Backblaze is also offering a free trial for listeners of Untitled Rothfuss, which you can check out at backblaze.com/untitled. And our sincere thanks to Backblaze for sponsoring Untitled Rothfuss with a very generous contribution to Pat's World Builders charity.
I bought a house. I am now part of the landed gentry. I know this is a world that you're familiar. You buy a lot of different buildings.
Yeah, I can tell. Yeah, I came to that game earlier than you. I bought a house. That was one of the first things I did when I had grown up money. And now I own a couple of different places. I got a place for World Builders. I helped out a local charity by buying a set of greenhouses that they would use to help out local farmers and do education and stuff in the community.
That one I haven't heard of before. That's awesome.
It's a place called Farm Shed. And you know, like you have a watershed to have like a healthy water in an ecosystem. And the term Farm Shed is kind of a callback to that, where like if you want to open a pizza joint, are there places where you can go to find how to run a pizza joint? Absolutely. But like, where do you go if you want to learn how to be a farmer? Like, nowhere. And the average age of a farmer in Wisconsin is something like 59 years old. Like the average age.
Maria is a farmer.
Maria is. And
how did she learn how to farm?
She came to it. Like, she does not come from farmers, and that's very rare for somebody to come in and just start farming, mm-hmm. because traditionally it's something you do if you're born to it, because you learn how, but also it's like there's no money in it. It's like if you're going to work an 80-hour week to like make no money, you usually, you know, you're doing something other than farming.
Right.
So Maria has come to be involved with Farm Shed too. But it's a cool charity, and they do education. They work with the university. They provide seedlings. Well, they teach people to garden too, you know, like, because odds are if you've never done gardening, how would you ever learn that? You know?
I got like a basil plant, but it died in 12 hours after it came into my apartment.
There's probably some trick to that.
Where's your million feet of lineal feet of bookshelves or whatever you have?
They're scattered throughout these various properties.
Okay.
And when I said that, we're referring to, I saw Max's office has put up a picture of some very enviable shelves, and he says, so many shelves, more shelves than I'll ever be able to fill. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I don't know about that. And he's like, no, seriously, there's so many shelves. And I said, I kind of closed my eyes for a couple, and I made a few notes, and then I bounced him back a message. I said, I have, at my best estimate, not counting books in storage, 1,500 linear feet of books.
That is insane. How do you acquire that many books?
How do you not? What else have I ever spent money on? Is just
books. I mean, I'm the same way with board games. Like, yeah. I have a huge tabletop game collection, but you know, it's my trade. Like, yeah. I want to know that stuff. Yeah.
It's for me. It's always been books. It, you know, as a kid, like, I'd make money, and then I would go to Walden Books, you know, and the mall, and I would.
Walden Books. Walden, are they still books. In business?
No, they went away.
That was a great bookstore.
It was a great bookstore. And when I was a kid, they had something called the Otherworlders Club. And it had like a little, you got a little card, and you got 10% off fantasy and sci-fi books. It was a great idea for them to do that. And
what were
like,
you, and what, how old, was this when you were like a kid? Like
kid,
young?
Kid.
What were you reading?
Narnia was my very first, and then I did Dragon Riders and... The Hobbit and the Lord of the Rings and ton of Piers Anthony. I read pretty much everything that he was one of the authors that I followed.
And how did you find out about this stuff? Like, because before pre-internet, like if your dad doesn't give you Lord of the Rings, I'm always curious, like, how does this geek culture kind of get passed down?
You know, I went into the library and I would just, you know, what's on the shelf. But most of it was I would go to Walden Books. That's what I spent, whenever we went to the mall, that's where I went. You know, if I got to go wander around on my own. And so I would look at the shelves, and that was probably like the only thing that I really spent money on was books. And I remember doing the math, because back then you could buy a paperback for like, maybe 2 1/4, 250, 295, like a 350 book was kind of pricey, you know, so I'd kind of make my choices a little bit there. But yeah, at some points I would look at those couple of walls of books and say, and I'd read fully half of them.
I'm curious, did you ever do that page per dollar math? As a
no,
kid?
No. I mean, sometimes when I would look, I'd be like, well, this book, you know, it's 350, but it's kind of a like a hefty book. But I never actually like did the math. Well, and it's one of those things that that happens online, where one of the constant outrage machines is when people get pissed off about how much something costs, and the cost of ebooks is fairly consistent there. You know, people, there's this weird line in people's heads. It's like, you know, an ebook should never cost more than $10. And I'm like, well, I mean, you just spent $7 on your cup of coffee that you're going to turn into piss by the end of the day. Whereas like this book, you know, is going to provide you with like 15 hours of entertainment, you know.
Oh, this is a big part of how video games get reviewed, is they're like, how many hours can you play the game for? And it's like, oh, we'll give it, you know, it's, oh, you can only play it for 40 hours. So it's like not a great value to you know, buy this game. That drives me, that kind of thing drives me up the wall. For me, when I was a kid, I've always been more of a sci-fi guy than a fantasy guy. So I had, you know, I read Narnia, I read Phantom Tollbooth. Those were, you know, I was into that. Harry Potter, but by that point I was already in middle school when Harry Potter came out. But my big books were, well, all the Bruce Colville stuff, which we've talked about before. He wrote these sort of like light sort of sci-fi romps for kids that also had some like grit to them that was kind of cool and challenging. And they had like a continuity so you could really learn the universe. And Animorphs was huge for me. I fucking grew up on just plowing through Animorphs.
That's crazy. I'm aware of them, but mm-hmm. only as like the word. I could not point one out. If you like lined up a Pokemon and an Animorph, and
someday I would be happy to sort of give you the whole story of the Animorphs, because it wound up it's a cool sci-fi universe. Like I still stand by it being pretty cool for kids literature. But the big one for me, like the big formative thing for me, was in fifth grade, my teacher, Mr. Nickel, sort of like under the table, slid me a copy of Ender's Game. And he was like, don't tell anyone I gave you this. And that book was just such crack, because when you're that age, when you're not old enough to sort of question whether the book makes sense or not, you're just sort of in the world. And it's the story of a kid who is smarter than everyone else, and he's getting bullied. and he uses his wits to become the most important person in the book. It just so appeals to you.
It is. It's a very legit, and I will admit I've only read it once, and I was in college at the time. But a friend gave it to me, and he says this is, you know, like, if you're going to consider yourself well read, he's like, this is one of the best books I've ever read. And you know, these days I do a lot more fantasy, but there were year long stretches where pretty much all I did was sci-fi.
We shouldn't digress down this too much, but it's the thing I love about you know, your fantasy world is that it's like hard fantasy.
Yep.
In that there are rules. Yep. You address the conservation of energy. Like, that is what I need to get into something, is I need there to be rules. It's a thing I think we've disagreed about this on Harry Potter, but I feel like Harry Potter has very good rules for the universe. And I love learning the rules and then seeing the characters break the rules. You're sort of rewarded with learning the system and then seeing the system be broken.
Right.
And like, man, that is totally the joy of reading, of reading your books, is like, you learn this very specific set of rules, and then it's exhilarating when he comes up with a new way to break the rules of magic or break the rules of the polite society. Like, it's just like,
yeah, you know. And I think, in my opinion, there's kind of two kinds of magic. You have what I call scientific magic and poetic magic. And scientific is one of the best examples is a book called Master of the Five Magics, which.
Scrambling for a pen.
It's one of those books that if you read a bunch of fantasy, or if you've probably only had it recommended to you because it was from ages ago, but like Larry Niven mentioned it once when I was like hanging out with him. He goes, you know, and first off, I'm not name dropping, because this was one of my very first conventions. And I was there because I knew I was supposed to go to conventions. I knew I was supposed to network. And so I went to a party, even though I hate parties. And it's one of those where everyone stands around and just kind of talks to no purpose because everyone's there because they're supposed to be at a party. Well, and except the people who are in the industry are there to talk to their friends, right?
Man, I'm so bad at those parties. Oh, literally, everyone's making small talk. I will literally walk up to someone and go, so how much money do you make? Like...
We should wingman one of those parties. We should go and just destroy it.
I don't know. It's like whatever. Like, you know, so when was the last time you took a shit? I don't know. Like, but the other thing that's hilarious is I love when you're at those parties and someone comes up to you and they're like, "So what do you do?" With this, with the obvious implication that they're going to decide whether it's worth talking to you or not.
Oh, man.
And my friend Merlin has this great thing where he says, I'm a ceramicist, and just like lets it hang. And if they're like, huh, okay, and they walk away, he knows that person is like a turd.
That is awesome.
Right?
That is awesome.
It's easier than being like, I don't know. For me, it's like, I don't know. What do? I make games, I make websites, and I do an internet thing. It's like, I don't even have a good answer for that.
Yeah. And this was one of those, but I learned, and actually the way that I learned this, it was one of my first things, one of my very first cons. Kevin Anderson helped kind of shepherd me into the industry. And so I was at a con, I stopped by his panel, I watched the panel, he got done and he was signing some books, and I talked to his wife. And she goes, how are you doing at your con? Because she knew that I was a total newbie. My book wasn't published yet. And I had an agent, like no publisher or anything. I was still like one of the people desperately clawing to try to get to know anyone or do anything in the publishing world. And she goes, so how's your con? I'm like, oh, good. She goes, did you get invited to any parties? And I said, I got invited to the tour party, but I'm not going to go. And she goes, why not? I go, I hate parties. You know, it's like I don't like drinking. I don't like being around drunk people. I don't like a lot of noise. I don't like crowds. So like everything there I hate. And she looked at me and she said, sweetheart, we don't go to these things because we enjoy them. Mm-hmm. We go to these things because it's our job. And I went, oh. And she said, I'll see you there. I say, I will. I'll go. And she goes, and I'll introduce you to some people. And I went, okay, cool. It's like, if this is the game, it's like, I'm going to play it. And so I showed up, and it was loud, and it was noisy. And there weren't drunks. There were people who may perhaps were buzzed, and people were drinking. But I forced myself to at least prove to myself that I could move in that environment, that I could make small talk. But of all the joys of being a successful author, the greatest joy for me is the knowledge that I need not do that anymore. I can go to a gathering and hang out and meet friends and whatever, but I am never forced to like mingle and small talk and desperately network with folks. Anyway, so this was back when I still did go to those parties to potentially meet people. And you know how the little conversational circles form? Mm-hmm. There was one of those, and we ended up next to Larry Niven. And because this is a writer con, and because he's, you know, a giant in the field, and he does marvelous work, and he's an intimidating-looking guy. Have you ever met him?
No.
He's white hair, white beard, just, I mean, and a serious face. He's a nice guy, but his demeanor is very serious.
I like a guy who looks like he came out of one of his own books. Like you've got a little bit of that going on.
I definitely look like a fantasy author or a fantasy creature, you know, either way.
Yeah.
But he's pretty intimidating, and he has the name badge. It says Larry Niven. I've been writing some of the best stuff in the genre for 40 years. And and everyone's kind of talking, and of course, books come up. And he said, and somebody's like, you know, talking about magic or whatever. He goes, one of the best books, is Bridge of Birds by Barry Hugart. And I looked over, I go, that was a beautiful, beautiful book. It was an amazing book. I'd never read anything like that. And nobody else had read it. So like, I'm like, Larry Niven named the book and I read it and we had a little moment and he doesn't know me from a hole in the ground, but I got to be a little bit cool for a tiny moment. And then the conversation moves on and somebody's talking about magic and I go, one of the best, you know, depictions of magic I've ever seen is Master of the Five Magics by Lyndon Hardy. And Larry Niven goes, that was a great book. And nobody else had read it. And so we had two of those little moments in the conversation. And I'm like, and I walked out of that party. I'm like, I have succeeded. He'll never remember me, but I proved that I could survive in that environment. And I felt like I was well read. I found out later, like literally like an hour later, that Peter S. Beagle had been at the party too, in the same conversational circle, but I hadn't recognized him.
I don't know who that is.
He wrote The Last Unicorn.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Which is my all-time favorite book, and it just breaks my heart every time I read it. But I didn't recognize him. So somebody said, yeah, Peter Beagle was like two people to your left. And I was just heartbroken that I'd been like a ship passing in the night and I hadn't even realized he'd been there. Because you know, I love Larry Niven's stuff and I respect his craft, but like, you know, there's a difference between that and this book that just you know rides next to your heart. Later on, I did get to meet Peter S. Beagle and he's a lovely guy, so I didn't blow it entirely. But yeah, I can't even remember why did I take us down this emotional or not emotional this conversational cul-de-sac.
It was like advice Larry Niven gave you about books, some books, something
magic.
Magic.
Right, systematic right. Magic.
Rules, yeah. Rules in a fantasy magic. World.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the thing I never got into about fantasy of like that I read, I like, I'm a nerd, I enjoy engaging with these heavy fantasy systems and learning them in great detail because I am then rewarded for having invested in it by like the rules of the thing coming to pass. You know, if there's a action, there's a consequence. And I've been disappointed with a lot of fantasy, including Lord of the Rings, which I've never been able to get into because it's like, wizard fixed it. I don't know. Like, you know, it's like this fantastical element like came out of nowhere. And, you know, it's like almost a trope of the genre that I can't stomach. And now there's this, I don't know what you call it, but this new wave of fantasy, of the kind of fantasy that you write and George R. R. Martin writes, where it's like self-aware. It is turning those tropes on their heads a little bit. It's playing with your expectations. And sometimes exactly what you think is going to happen is what happens because that's how life is.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting you mentioned Lord of the Rings in terms of magic because, like I said, there's this scientific magic, which, you know, sympathy, pretty much. Sigildry, pretty much. You know, you can do the math on those. And the
I love how boring. How do you say it?
Sigildry.
Sigildry.
Yeah.
I love how boring it seems in the book. Like, it delights me. It's one of my favorite literary constructs in a fantasy world ever. That there's this really cool form of magic and it's extremely boring. nothing could be better than that, because that is the human condition, right? That is using the fantastical to talk about something that we all know about ourselves, which is we could go know things about the world, but it's really hard and boring.
But it's really hard and boring. There's a lot of math. It's like you want to be a marine biologist, you got to get through organic chem.
Right.
And not just a little organic chem, like all the organic chem. Right. Want to swim with the dolphins? First organic chem.
Yeah. And it's in Harry Potter, to give a counterexample, Harry will occasionally go to magical history class, which is supposed to be the boring class. And there's always J.K. Rowling will always drop in a few lines of Professor Binns' boring lecture. And it's the best part of the book. I'm like, tell me, I want to know about the Goblin Wars. Don't just leave that hanging out there. That's so cool. I want to know that texture. But the Sigildry, you get a feeling of how mechanical it is and how meticulous it is. And it's just that you get that sense of it being a science that's really difficult and boring.
Well, and the benefit of that sort of magic is just what you said. There are rules, and you as the reader get to know those rules. And that means later, when someone is clever about those rules, you're able to look at that and go, wow, that is legitimately, that's a really clever way to work the system.
It's the difference between when I guess spoiler alert, when Quoth makes the arrow catch.
Yeah.
When he makes that thing, it's the difference between you as the author needing to step in and say, it was a very clever invention, and me as the reader going, holy shit, that's a clever invention.
I want one of those in my adventuring party.
Yeah.
But here's the downside to that kind of magic. It's that it is not, in a lot of senses, it is not magical, by which I mean it is not mysterious. It is not, it doesn't possess, and here's one of my favorite words and one of my favorite concepts. It's not numinous. It doesn't have this ethereal, mysterious, unarticulatable quality to it. Now,
that's a philosophy word.
Yeah, it's a total. It's a 50-cent word. Mm-hmm. The other type of magic, and it's more a spectrum. It's not an either or thing. Is what I consider poetic magic, and poetic magic is the realm of the numinous, where, and I'm trying to think of a good example. Well, and honestly, Lord of the Rings, because nobody says okay. Conservation of energy, you've got runes. Gandalf has 5 fourth level spells, and he already knows his prismatic spray, so that takes up one slot. And it's not like that. What happens is Gandalf, it's like he's in the caves. Yeah, and this is out of the Hobbit. So if you haven't read it, right, spoiler alert. In the caves, right, goblins come out, and Gandalf has Bilbo cries out, buys Gandalf a few seconds of time, and there's a flash and a crack of light, and a couple of goblins go down dead, and Gandalf is not there anymore. And you're like, how did he do that? You don't know. It's fucking magic. You're not a wizard. And then later, he's trapped, up in the tree, and he lights some pine cones on fire, and he throws those down, and it catches the wargs on fire. And later, he does smoke and magic. He does fireworks. And you never know what he's capable of. But here's the interesting thing. As a kid reading that, and other structural things, you probably keep you from really enjoying those books at this point in your life. It's sometimes easier when you're a kid and you get books earlier. But what it is Gandalf is mysterious just because you don't know quite what he can do. He can't fix everything, because otherwise it would just be fire from the heavens. I'm going to just screw all you wolves and goblins, and everyone walks out. He tries some things and he's useful, but then he's tapped,
I'm like the gears in my head are spinning, and I'm thinking about Kingslayer Chronicles. I'm like, you clever bastard. You have your cake and you eat it too.
I have my cake and I eat it too. It's the naming magic.
Yep.
And that's the magic that defies explication. And it is the truly mysterious, undescribable, unexplicable magic. And it's the one... and then you even have the ones in between where alchemy... He's kind of on that fence. You know, it's a little bit like chemistry, but the little bits we've seen, you know, Simon makes it real clear to Quoth. It's like, this isn't chemistry. You're going to fuck yourself up if you think it is. And Quoth, in true Quoth fashion, like, doesn't believe him, right?
Yeah.
And so Simon really has to make him, like, eat it to acknowledge the fact that he does not know what's going on here. There you have the opportunity for wonder. And that's the benefit of numinous magic, is wonder. When something happens, you're like, whoa. And that, you can still get the whoa with scientific magic, but it's cleverness and admiration is what you get. You admire the cleverness and you go, wow, I admire that cleverness. But the wonder, it's like, that happened. It's like, whoa.
But maybe this is my, maybe you'll find this like terribly like cynical. But like to me, I feel like, you know, that's life. Though you don't get wonder delivered to you in the sense of poetic magic. That is not part of the human experience, especially in this day and age when you can go on Wikipedia and, you know, find out how the universe works. But it is nonetheless important to find some wonder. Like you kind of have to work for it. Like it's kind of that, like, I have to like psych myself up a little bit to like really really experience wonder about like astronomy, for example. I mean, it can be done, but you don't just like, it's not magical. You have to understand it and be like, oh my God, we're spinning around at 1,000 miles a minute on a piece of rock in the middle of nothing. And it by accident, like that, I can really start to like freak myself out.
Right. Well, and the pursuit of wonder, you know, or the ability to achieve wonder, it's, I don't know if it's the divining characteristic of what one of the main things that you can achieve with fantasy, but it's certainly, it's. I think it might be easier for us in some instances. But, you know, and I think about here, well, allow me to like vastly side shift us. Mm-hmm. The Dalai Lama. Mm-hmm. I love the way that the Dalai Lama laughs, you know, like if you've ever seen him talk to somebody about it, he's always laughing. And, you know, laughter a lot of times comes from transgression. You know, there's some transgression. There's some surprise. There is some subversion of expectation. And I'm vastly simplifying here. That we could talk for a week straight on humor and not scratch the surface. But, you know, you can also laugh at something. And this is my favorite humor, and it's, in my opinion, the purest humor. Because a lot of humor comes from something really shitty happening to somebody, and then you laugh about it. And if you don't think that is true, think of every time you've laughed when you've seen somebody get hit in the nuts. You know, it is just, you're like, somebody takes it square in the nuts and they keel over and you just laugh. Why? That's how we're wired. And it's maybe not good, it's maybe not healthy, but it is funny. The humor of misfortune. Now, there's this very narrow band, and it's the humor of the ridiculous. And of course, if you can get both, you know, suffering and ridiculous, those tend to be the most humorous instances, which I'm singing to the choir here, because, you know, transgression, ridiculousness, and suffering is Cards Against Humanity in a nutshell.
But in the among the 8 writers of Cards Against Humanity, I'm the ridiculousness guy. Because that's true comedy.
Yes, to me.
That's
it is.
Like philosophical. That's like the human condition comedy. I mean, that's like great literature comedy.
Exactly. It's the deep magic from the dawn of time, yeah, is what it is. And it's very rare to achieve. But here's why the Dalai, that is why the Dalai Lama is laughing all the time. And he has this absolutely joyous, rich, wonderful laugh. And I saw him, he met this old Buddhist nun. And, you know, I mean, and he ain't no spring chicken either, but this woman was really old. And she was there. And it's all in a different language, and it's all subtitled. He comes up to her, and he says, "How are you? How are you?" And she goes, "Oh, not so good." He says, have you been eating?" And she goes, "No, I don't think I'm going to eat anymore. I haven't been eating much. I don't want to eat." And he goes, and he laughs. You know, he laughs, and he goes, "Well, you need to eat." You know? And it's because, you know, what a comedian does is help expose the ridiculousness of our everyday lives. Right. That's their magic. That's their trick. But what the trick that the Dalai Lama has performed is that he, you know, and the trick of Buddhism is that you realize how silly, how impermanent, how unreal is all of this everything. And so in that context and from that perfect position, somebody's like, "Well, you know, I'm just not hungry and I don't think I'm going to eat anymore and I'm very old and I'll die." And what can you do but say, "Yeah, that's a hell of a thing, isn't it?" You know, and he laughs and he's like, "But you know, you got to eat." And I just, I wish I were more like the Dalai Lama, you know. And previously in my life, I actually have been more like the Dalai Lama. I've been in the place much closer to being able to continuously appreciate the divine absurdity of the human condition and all creation. And I prided myself, and I was filled with joy much more often. You know, and I've fallen, you know, from that path because it's so easy to get tangled up in the world. I've been thinking about that lately a lot about, who said it? "I'm too much with the world, getting and spending." It's probably Thoreau or Emerson or one of those wankers.
So one of these transcendentalist jokers.
Yeah,
man, that's heavy. Do you have you ever attempted to meditate? Now it's going to get preachy. I'm going to like tell you to watch The Wire or something.
Like... you know, do you ever read Raymond Feist's Magician Apprentice, Magician Master?
No, it's on my list because you've told me to read it though.
It's it was one of those early books, and in there, you know, you learned how he learned magic, and it was really interesting because, and you know, actually here you can see a fingerprint on my work where his, you know, Pug's teacher said to him, "Okay, we got to prepare your mind if you're going to do magic." And it wasn't like, "Oh, you were the chosen one." It's like this poor little fucking orphan boy was the only one left and nobody had chosen him as an apprentice. And so the magician is like, "Yes, you." And he's like, "Why did you choose me?" He's like, "I felt sorry for you, you chump. You know, we didn't want to cast you out of the city." And so it's like, "How am I going to teach you? Do this with your mind, you know, practice not thinking about a dog, you know?" And I'm like, "What an interesting thought." And so I would practice not thinking of something. I've actually gotten to the point where I can do that. You know, you can give me something and I can actually find a way to put it out of my mind, which is I'm kind of proud of that. Now strict like transcendental meditation, I did a little bit of that when I studied Budokai Karate. Like you would sit and try to find like peace, you know, but anything strict or long-term, no. You?
Yeah, I just got into like Zazen Buddhist meditation, the most simple, boring kind of meditation there is in college.
I don't think there's extreme meditation.
There is. There's like meditation where you do stuff. There's walking meditation.
Oh, that's
right.
There's
guided meditations where you can get an app on your iPhone and a lady's voice will tell you what to do. But the thing that I found, that has really helped me deal with, my like anxiety issues to the point where like, I've never bothered to like go try to get medication, medicated for this because, I've managed to like, get it under control and lead a normal life. I try to make time every day and, it really could not be simpler, which is you sit down in a comfortable position, and you make your back straight. And the reason for that is not any spiritual reason. It's just because it's easier to sit there for a long time. These guys know what they're doing.
They're practical people.
They're very practical. And you start by thinking about your breathing, the way that you're breathing, and you try and take deep breaths. And again, it's just very practical. It's because if you take deep breaths, you can sit there for longer and be comfortable. You focus on your breathing, nothing but your breathing, and then you try to focus on nothing. You try to not do anything. And it's, of course, impossible. You can't think about nothing. The Buddha did it one time, allegedly.
Right.
Allegedly. Right. And he became enlightened in that moment. But it's, of course, impossible. It's an impossible goal, but you try to do it every day anyway, even though you can never do it. And here's the exercise. You have a thought. For me, it's usually like a panicky, oh my God, I forgot to do this thing or what, whatever it is, right? And you just say to yourself, I am having that thought and I'm going to let it go away. And you return to your breathing and you just think about breathing more and you just do that for 20 minutes and then you get up and you stretch and you're like, I'm now done with that. And that thought technology, possessing that thought technology inside your head where you can say to yourself, okay, I'm having that thought, I'm having that feeling, and I'm aware that I'm having it, I'm okay with it, I'm going to let it go, I'm going to ride it out. Like, I mean, that is like a, for me at least, I really feel like it's a superpower. It's just like, it's the thing that got me excited about philosophy, which is this idea of like, philosophers carry their tools everywhere they go.
Yeah.
It's a trade where you don't need, it's like, you don't need any special gizmos or gadgets. You just learn these thought technologies. It's like ways to ask questions, ways to define terms. And, the benefits to me of meditation are much the same of like, it's just that ability to be like, I recognize that I'm having this thought and I'm going to let it go.
So is mindfulness something that is the term that has been used with what you have learned?
Yep. That's it. That's the goal, is to be mindful. And, the idea is that you start your day off by sitting and trying to, let go of your thoughts. And then you can go through the rest of your day and you can do things in a mindful fashion where it's like when you're chopping an onion to make dinner, you are not also planning a work thing and having it. You're not doing a million things. You're just in the moment chopping the onion. I'm not good at that. I mean, I'm not good at these things.
Right.
I do them anyway, and I seem to get some benefit from it.
Well, and nobody's good at anything starting out, right. And it is interesting because I know that a lot of the problems in my life, it's not that my life is bad. It's that I am not, usually enjoying my life. And the times that I have enjoyed my life, it's not that, I didn't get to have dinner with, my family. It's that, I didn't enjoy having dinner with my family because I was thinking about the things that I had to do and I could.
That's a hell of a rabbit hole too. Once you start thinking about that.
Exactly.
It's that great, David Foster Wallace quote, am I happy is one of those questions that if it needs to be asked, it pretty much answers itself.
Yes, that's exactly it. That's exactly it. And, I even had, like one day I'm like, it's Thanksgiving, I'm not going to worry about work today. And I had a great day, and hung out and played with the kids and we had dinner and I helped cook it, which I neglect a lot of times. Sarah does most of the cooking, although I enjoy cooking. And it wasn't so much that I did all of those things. It's that I was living in that moment and not fretting about anything, not worried about you know, having to catch up on the work that I was missing and stuff like that. My mom did some meditation too, and she used to talk about it. And she talked about the monkey mind.
Yep. That's what it's, yeah, that's that idea of like you sit down and you have a million thoughts racing through your head, and you're like, I wonder what's happening with that news story, and like, is it, you're just thinking about whatever, all that just crazy bullshit that happens in your head. That's that. That's monkey mind.
Yep, and like monkey mind, you're sitting there. It's like breathe and think of nothing. Just exist, and then it's like, what am I going to make for dinner tonight? No, no, no. And she goes, you go get the monkey. You bring the monkey. No, we're going to sit here and be quiet, and then. Oh, my ass is really itchy, you know. And you're like,
I mean, just to recognize within yourself that's happening to you. It's a revolution. It's like a crazy.
Yeah.
It's like a crazy superpower. And I do sometimes think of like just how many people in the world they just don't even have that basic self awareness of like what they're thinking about, what they're spending their.
Do you ever read the. The Tiffany Aching books, the Terry Pratchett, because Terry Pratchett wrote Discworld, and there was
I read Discworld when I was a kid, but I don't know these.
He wrote them as part of the series. They're mm-hmm. in the Discworld world, mm-hmm. and Tiffany Aching is this young girl, and they are beautiful. You know, it's Pratchett at the height of his power, and Tiffany Aching is this little 10-year-old girl who, you know. Discovers that she's a witch or decides to be a witch. Mm-hmm. Just, and it's not so much that she's like, now I'm a witch. She's like, huh, things are going wrong. I guess I'm just going to have to take care of this. And it's such, I could not love those books more, but so she goes and like, she finds somebody. It's like, so what is a witch? You know, I think we need somebody who can take care of this. That would be a witch, wouldn't it? And there aren't any. She's like, well, fine. I guess I'm just going to have to deal with this myself. But she refers to what is it? She has the first sight and second thoughts. And the first sight is seeing things that are actually there. Which is a great talent to have, mm-hmm. as opposed to seeing what you expect to see. Mm-hmm. And second thoughts are when you think, but then you think about the fact that you're thinking. And she thinks about this. And these are, it's like such a cool way to bring this concept to young kids. And it's, I don't think Pratchett did it with the intention of like, let's teach children about Buddhist thought. But it's remarkable that shows up there.
Did you see the new Pixar movie Inside Out?
I have not yet managed to. Sarah, one of us was going to get to go see it with Oot. And
how old is he?
He's almost six.
Okay, so one of my friend Scott has a kid who's two, three, and he made it through Inside Out, and he was entertained.
I believe
and
it.
Got some of the concepts of this idea of like, you know, the premise of the movie that the little characters are the emotions.
Yeah.
And he's like, and he'll say something like, you know, I have anger in my mind right now, which is like crazy for a kid that, yeah, I mean, you don't have theory of mind yet. Right. So it's it's just this crazy thing. But like, I mean, what a gift that Pixar has given to kids to give them this sort of beautiful language to be,
yeah. Well, and even with Oot, as he grows up, it's something that Sarah has been good, because what happens is, you know, my boy has grown up very, very articulate. And part of that, I believe, is because of superior genetics. But a piece of that is because, you know, Sarah's a really great mom. She puts in the work. You know, we made some good decisions, and we've tried to make our policies consistent in terms of their execution as parents. But the other thing that we have is awkward pause on the radio. What the fuck were you talking about, Rothfuss?
Self-reflexive and right. Very literate.
So he's very articulate.
Yeah.
And we read to him a lot, and that's what makes him articulate. But, and so he'll come up to you and he'll talk to you with like this incredible language, and he'll be very precise and exact in his speech. And it's easy to forget and that he has all of these emotions, but he does not have tools or skills or habits for coping with his emotions. And so you tend to assume that he is more mature emotionally than he really is. And the same thing can be true with adults, honestly. You know, a lot of very articulate
people.
Yeah,
I hope when you go back and listen to this episode, to that description, that you realize that you're describing yourself. But please go on. Please go on. Yeah.
And, you know, but what's really interesting is you see him get mad, like as a 3-year-old or a 4-year-old. And when it hits him, you know, because like for a 1-year-old or a 2-year-old, anger is like, where is the, it's like, I am hurt and this, and I'm scared. Then you cry. Or it's like, where is my tit? You know, it's like, I am hungry and I will die and I am pissed about this.
Well, when little kids get angry, it possesses them.
It's just,
I mean, it's
pure rage.
Yeah.
And there's just, it's primordial. If you've ever seen one of these tiny babies cry, it is like, it goes right down to your lizard brain and you're like, shit, something is so wrong. But then like you learn to have expectations about the world. And then when an expectation disappoints you, then you have a more mature anger, like actual anger as opposed to just like a biological reflex. And watching him, you know, and honestly, it's really natural for a kid to just hit somebody because that's what you do as a monkey. You know, I am angry. I'm going to hit you to express this. And so Sarah would talk him through and say, you know, you need to, it's like, are you angry? It's okay to be angry. What do you do when you're angry? You know, and giving him some tools to talk about this. Are you sad? You know, which it seems weird or like very touchy-feely or very hippie or whatever to like try to have that conversation with your kid. But you have to give them language so that they can think about what's going on in their own heads.
I mean, Mr. Rogers used to talk about this all the time, that was the thesis of his show.
Yeah.
Is that our society does not adequately prepare children to talk about feelings and to understand that feelings are understandable and mentionable.
Yeah.
And that was his goal of his life, was to give kids a vocabulary to understand that they're having feelings and to talk about them.
You know, and talk about like a solid force for good in the world. You know, there's some people you can point to and say, there it is. You know, and you cannot argue with this. Did you see... Have you seen the video clip where Mr. Rogers goes up like in front of the Senate committee? We got to put that in underneath
right,
this podcast.
I'm going to drop it in. It is one of my favorite things. And I actually I show that when I often do talks about like how do you talk about a project that you want to do or communicate it. And so not only is it him sort of
it's a pitch meeting.
Laying out. So not only is it him sort of laying out the central thesis of his life's work in a very public setting, but it is also one of the most masterful examples of communicating his values, of going into a conversation that's not going his way and speaking with values language and completely flipping it so that it doesn't become a question of like a budgetary meeting about funding for public television. It becomes this question of right and wrong, and there's only one side to be. That is the kind of it's the kind of righteous linguistic jujitsu that I mean that is what I would like to master with my life, and so it's so rare that you see it happen. Okay, so I'm gonna play it. I'll put it in the episode. Let me set it up real quick, which is Fred Rogers, a young Mr. Rogers, Fred Rogers, is called in front of Congress to testify because PBS has a $10 million congressional allotment to do programming. And they want to cut. The Republicans want to cut it because they don't believe in, you know, the government should be making TV or whatever. And they call in Mr. Rogers, and it's sort of this crazy, okay, Mr. Rogers, defend yourself,
justify your existence.
Yeah, what do you have to say? And you can tell, like, they've brought him in, and they don't want to listen to him. And he speaks for maybe 5 minutes, and it completely flips the script on them.
And I will also say, Are you going to put in the audio here?
Yeah, I'll drop it in.
Oh, cool, cool. Yeah. It is, and I'll just be quiet here. We'll pause. And I'll also, if you can find the video clip, it is worth watching his face. Because just seeing his body language, it's rare to see. And remember this time period. These days, if you're a social progressive and you're living in certain communities, it's okay for to be a guy and talk about feelings and all this stuff. But Mr. Rogers was there, like, this was 40 years ago, you know, and he was in the trenches up in, like, you know, he was in front of the eye of Sauron there. And, but like the complete unguarded sincerity, you know, it was like, that is something that I occasionally brush up against. You know, like it, I feel like I have the ability to get a little close to that sometimes. But I remember seeing that and almost not realizing before that moment that you could see a person sincerely and simply talk about love or anything, like not in an angry way, not in a passionate way, just in a pure, honest, earnest way. And it breaks my heart. I weep every time. I just cry like a baby every time I look at this. I watch that video.
All right, Rogers, you got the floor.
Senator Pastore, this is a philosophical statement and would take about 10 minutes to read, so I'll not do that. One of the first things that a child learns in a healthy family is trust. And I trust what you have said, that you will read this. It's very important to me. I care deeply about children. My first children...
Will it make you happy if you read it?
I'd just like to talk about it, if it's all right. Sir. I feel that if we in public television can only make it clear that feelings are mentionable and manageable, we will have done a great service for mental health. I think that it's much more dramatic that two men could be working out their feelings of anger. Much more dramatic than showing something of gunfire.
Do you narrate it?
I'm the host, yes. And I do all the puppets, and I write all the music, and I write all the scripts.
Well, I'm supposed to be a pretty tough guy, and this is the first time I've had goosebumps for the last 2 days.
Well, I'm grateful, not only for your goosebumps, but for your interest in our kind of communication. Could I tell you the words of one of the songs, which I feel is very important?
Yes.
This has to do with that good feeling of control, which I feel that the children need to know is there. And it starts out, what do you do with the mad that you feel? And that first line came straight from a child. I work with children, doing puppets in very personal communication with small groups. What do you do with the mad that you feel when you feel so mad you could bite? When the whole wide world seems oh so wrong and nothing you do seems very right? What do you do? Do you punch a bag? Do you pound some clay or some dough? Do you round up friends for a game of tag or see how fast you go? It's great to be able to stop when you've planned a thing that's wrong and be able to do something else instead and think this song. I can stop when I want to, can stop when I wish, can stop, stop, stop anytime. And what a good feeling to feel like this and know that the feeling is really mine. Know that there's something deep inside that helps us become what we can. For a girl can be someday a lady, and a boy can be someday a man.
I think it's wonderful. I think it's wonderful. Looks like you just earned the $20 million.